start off by apologizing. My brother would love to be here and sends his regards. And the apology would be for my delivery of his work, which won't be anything like his delivery of his work, but we'll do our best. Images, poetry, fragmentation, and the wish for wholeness. I'm very pleased to be included in this series of distinguished speakers. My only teaching of modernist literature is in a 19th and 20th century survey course. And however well a teacher may do such a course, it is inevitably like a tour of 10 European cities in 10 days, useful for gaining some general impressions, but not so useful for details. I think it is fair to suggest that the general impression of modernism conveyed by the survey anthologies is that of a movement which shattered previous cultural paradigms into fragments. The violence of words, such as shattered and fragments, is certainly evident before 1914. For example, in the Knock It All Down credo of futurism, but clearly World War I itself has become the dominant symbol of a tectonic plate shift in Western society. This is described variously by historians as a time not only of the breaking of nations, as Thomas Hardy put it, but as a time of the breakdown of master narratives of religion, empire, politics, gender, and culture. Yeah, it works. I find it useful to think of the imagists in the historical context provided by my survey course. Is the romantic manifesto of Wordsworth's preface to the Lyrical Ballads in 1798 rebelled against neoclassical poetic forms, and as the mid-century pre-Raphaelites rebelled against the artistic canons of the Royal Academy in 1848, the imagists rebelled against 19th century notions of poetry, which included very long narrative poems, poems such as The Prelude, Aurora Leigh, Idylls of the King, and others. Such very long poems inevitably include passages which are more prosaic and less intense. The imagists develop principles defining genuine poetry as necessarily brief and intense. It is natural enough that the poems of two or three lines should be regarded by many as fragments, and their fragmentary nature should be understood as symbolic of a period of cultural fragmentation. My purpose is not to dispute the obvious truth of this, but merely to complicate it a bit by considering ways in which some of these fragments might also be more than that, or strive to be more than that. I will have time only to discuss a few examples, and I'll conclude with a few comments about imagism and other modernist works. Let's begin with Thomas Ernest Hume. Hume was born in the village of Endon in 1883. After local schooling, he came to St. John's College at Cambridge to study mathematics. More than anything else, he loved to talk and gained a reputation as a great controversialist, who, as someone later expressed it, would, quote, argue the hind leg off a dog, end quote. A contemporary at St. John's College said that sometimes Hume, quote, talked great nonsense. When it was nonsense, he was fully aware of the fact, but not all his listeners were, end quote. There are various stories about why Hume was sent down from Cambridge in 1904, his fellow students giving him a mock funeral and riding him out of town in a coffin. Hume really wanted to study philosophy. His father asked him, "What's the sense of that? No use at all in Staffordshire." Hume registered to study biology and physics at University College London, but for the next 2 years, he spent most of his time in Cambridge auditing philosophy lectures. In July of 1906, Hume told a favorite aunt he'd rather live on bread and cheese than enter civil service, and he took passage on a cargo boat for Montreal. He spent some time in Toronto, but it was his experience of the Canadian prairies which was life-changing for him. In his lecture on modern poetry, he wrote, quote, "The first time I ever felt the necessity or inevitableness of the verse was in the desire to reproduce the peculiar quality of feeling which is induced by the flat spaces and wide horizons of the Virgin Prairie of Western Canada," end quote. He returned to Europe in 1907, spent a year in Brussels, then in 1908 began writing for The New Age, a Fabian-associated publication. He had a strong influence on Ezra Pound when they were both members of an informal poets group which met at a Soho restaurant called the Eiffel Tower. It was Pound who coined the term imagism and wrote the manifesto based on ideas discussed in the Eiffel Tower group. Hume's literary output was a mere handful of poems. Among the most anthologized is Autumn. "A touch of cold in the autumn night, I walked abroad and saw the ruddy moon lean over a hedge like a red-faced farmer. I did not stop to speak, but nodded, and round about were the wistful stars with white faces like town children." The personification of moon and stars is a romantic device which suggests a kind of fellowship between the worlds of nature and humanity, the ambiguity of which is whimsically captured in the fifth line, "I did not stop to speak, but nodded." In a less obvious way, this fragment of the speaker's experience seems to involve a narrative sequence in its past tense verbs, but it is really a single moment of perception. The binary tension of being and becoming reflects Hume's passion for philosophy and embodies a metaphysical idea without using any philosophical language. Another of Hume's better known poems is Above the Dock, where he describes the moon tangled in the cords of a tall mast as, quote, "a child's balloon forgotten after play," end quote. Another expression of the philosophical binary of action and stillness. Some of Hume's poems and fragments have led to the observation that he is not really an imagist poet. For example, "Some were the gods, the blanket makers of the prairie cold, sleep in their blankets." Patrick McGinnis, in his recent edition of Hume's writings, argues that Hume is interested in figurative language as a whole, including similes, and not only in the narrower notion of metaphorical equivalencies espoused by Ezra Pound. A speculation about blanket-making gods is, in a way, a metaphysical assertion rather than an image in the tighter sense. McGinnis cites two of Hume's fragments, his masterpieces. "The flounced edge of a skirt, recoiling like waves off a cliff. And old houses were scaffolding once, and workmen whistling." The major time shift from the solidity of the houses being to the process of their becoming is encompassed within eight words. Hume enlisted as a private when the war began in August 1914. He was wounded in April 1915 and sent home to recuperate. Ezra Pound reported that Hume, quote, "read Kant and Hegel in the hospital in Wimbledon, in the original, and the hospital staff didn't like it." Pound also recorded the following poem from Hume's conversation. "Over the flat slopes of St. Eloise, a wide wall of sandbags, night. In the silence, desultory men, pottering over small fires, cleaning their mess tins, to and fro from the lines, men walk as on Piccadilly, making paths in the dark, through scattered dead horses, over a dead Belgian's belly. The Germans have rockets, the English have no rockets. Behind the line, cannon, hidden, lying back miles. Before the line, chaos. My mind is a corridor. The minds about me are corridors. Nothing suggests itself. There is nothing to do but keep on." Hume wrote essays to challenge pacifist views of those like Bertrand Russell, but there is no shred of the glorification of war for him. The final lines of the trenches, St. Eloi, speak of an endless corridor, an endless process of moving, becoming, nothing to do but keep on keeping on. Yet the image of the corridor carries with it in a ghostly way, as soldiers who have lost limbs still feel the phantom limb is real. The image of some place where the corridor ends, since corridors are by definition passages from somewhere to somewhere. Hume's corridor was not to be a long one. In 1916, he was commissioned in the Royal Marines Artillery and was killed in shelling in September 1917. More than any other member of the Images Circle, Ezra Pound's name is probably the first to be thought of by most people, and this is mostly because of one poem, In a Station of the Metro. The apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bowl. This is a quintessential Images poem, according to Pound's requirement of expressing a total experience in a single image, or in this case, two images juxtaposed to create a metaphor. In poetry collections, it is usually accompanied by Pound's account in 1916 of how he came to write it. Quote, 3 years ago in Paris, I got out of a metro train at La Concorde and saw suddenly a beautiful face, and then another, and another, and then a beautiful child's face, and then another beautiful woman. And I tried all day to find words for what this had meant to me. And I could not find any words that seemed to me worthy or as lovely as that sudden emotion. And that evening, I was still trying and I found suddenly the expression. I do not mean that I found words, but there came an equation, not in speech, but in little splotches of color. End quote. Pound's first attempt was a poem of 30 lines, which 6 months later became 15 lines, and after that became the haiku-like poem we have today. If you can put up with a little explication, there are some interesting technical qualities to this fragment. It is a metaphor rather than a simile. The faces are not merely like petals, but in some sense they are the petals, connecting the human world with nature as Hume does, though in a more subtle way in this case. The semicolon at the end of the first line asserts both difference and connection, as does the slight off-rhyming of crowd and bow. The choice of apparition rather than appearance brings connotations of some ghostly transference from one image to the other. It also has one more syllable, with the effect on the sound of the poem. The relative lightness of the first line, with so many unstressed syllables, settles and comes to rest, as it were, in the three stressed syllables which end the poem. Another suggestion of the Platonic philosophical binary of action and stillness, becoming and being. The stated aim of Pound's poem was not to express brokenness or fragmentation, but wholeness. It is a tiny poem, but perhaps it may be compared to looking through a pinhole at the grandeur of the night sky. However, before we depart Pound's metro station, there is a question about the idea of finding some exact equivalent in words to an experience. If we did not have Pound's explanation, could we say if the experience of this speaker is happy or sad? It could be either, neither, or both. So in a way, the brevity of an Images poem makes it something of an inkblot. I hope you won't mind a brief personal digression. My grandfather, John A. Fraser, was a contemporary of the Imagists. He was born in 1890, graduated in arts from St. Dunstan's University, the precursor to UPEI, and he taught in PEI in Western Canada before he enlisted near the end of the war and was transferred to Europe. He served in the 1st Canadian Tank Corps. It occurred to me that to see the world through the slit of a tank in brief flashes would indeed be an experience of fragmentation. A memoir of World War I tank warfare by a British officer speaks of the drivers peering anxiously through the slit, but seeing nothing. Then, in desperation, putting an ear to the slit in case he could somehow hear where they were going. After the war, my grandfather settled in Regina, taking a law degree at Wetmore Hall. I'd like to offer this little talk as a thank you for the World War I service of John A. Fraser. The uncertainty or subjectivities of interpretation certainly applies to another frequently anthologized imagist work, Hilda Doolittle's 1915 poem, The Pool. Are you alive? I touch you. You quiver like a sea fish. I cover you with my net. What are you, banded one? The usual professorial response to students who say a poem means whatever they say it means is, quote, as long as you have the evidence to support your opinion. Alas, however scientific modern literary criticism has become, we're still a long way from precision in saying what poems mean. I think this is a poem about catching a poem, with the band suggesting the lines of print, although that is somewhat literal. The closer a work approaches pure symbol, or as Pater put it, the closer it approaches to the condition of music, the more difficult to describe paraphrasable meaning, except with careful qualifiers that it could or it might suggest this or that. Hilda Doolittle, or H.D., was born in Pennsylvania in 1886, but lived most of her life in Europe. At the end of World War II, which H.D. spent in London, she published three volumes of poetry on the theme of war. But in the Imagist period, she is most identified with shorter pieces, especially Oread, also of 1915. Whirl up, see, whirl your pointed pines, splash your great pines on our rocks, hurl your green over us, cover us with your pools of fur. A number of the pieces we have looked at so far imply some identity between the human and the natural worlds. This poem does so in its asking of the sea to cover us, as well as in its suggestion of a unity transcending the divide between land and sea, which in the symbol dictionaries often represent time and eternity, another formulation of the philosophical binary of becoming and being. H.D. married Richard Aldington in 1913. Aldington, who was born in Portsmouth, published his first volume of poetry in 1909 and was also one of the founding members of Imagism. With H.D., he published a collection called Images Old and New in 1915, based on translations from Greek and Latin short poems. He was editorially involved in the radical literary periodicals Egoist and Blast, both of which titles tend to fit the stereotype of fragmentation. Although Aldington has been described as an angry young man a generation early, one of his best known pieces called Evening is more in the comic vein. The chimneys, rank on rank, cut the clear sky. The moon, with a rag of gauze about her loins, poses among them, an awkward Venus. And here am I looking wantonly at her over the kitchen sink. The chimneys of the world cut, or one might say fragment, the clear sky, but the speaker yearns for union with this awkward Venus and the natural world she represents. In 1916, Aldington enlisted in the infantry. He returned home with a case of shell shock, which affected his life for years after. Here are two Imagist pieces based on his experience. First, Living Sepulchres. One frosty night, when the guns were still, I leaned against the trench, making for myself haku of the moon and flowers and of the snow. But the ghostly scurrying of huge rats, swollen with feeding upon man's flesh, filled me with shrinking dread. The fragmentations here include binary tensions between the stillness and the dreadful scurrying, the creative and the destructive ugliness and beauty. The wish for transcendence of this divided condition is, in this piece, only a faint implication, due to the negative effect of the word but, which begins the second part. Without this, parts 1 and 2 would tend to more balance or equipoise. Or if the parts were reversed, but I leaned against the trench, the effect would be a more positive statement about the hope to transcend war's ugly reality. Another of Aldington's war pieces comes nearer to this, called Insouciance. In and out of the dreary trenches, trudging cheerily under the stars, I make for myself little poems, delicate as a flock of doves. They fly away like white-winged doves. What strikes me here is the word cheerily in line 2. Could it suggest that the making of art, this wonderful human capacity to imagine and produce works of art, is in fact one of the most important ways we have to transcend our experiences of division and fragmentation? Before I conclude, allow me to make a brief comment about Imagism in relation to the wider literary movement of modernism. In the Renaissance, Walter Pater describes our subjective life as a whirlpool, a rushing stream. Quote, the passage and dissolution of impressions, images, sensations, end quote. An anticipation of the narrative mode often identified with modernism, stream of consciousness. One aspect of the breakdown of master narratives is breakdown of the narrative that some objective reality exists. In this period, even the objective certainties of science were changing. For example, with Einstein's theory of relativity of 1915, reality does not exist, but is constantly being created by interaction of the observer with what is observed. In this context, it seems reasonable to suggest that many of the important modernist texts are, in some sense, imagist. For example, there are Leopold Bloom's Peregrinations Around Dublin, in which the real story is the sequence of his thoughts, many in sentence fragments, ranging from the most elevated spiritual questionings to the most basic of human bodily functions. Or there is the imagist poem which begins The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot. The evening is spread out against the sky, like a patient etherized upon a table. A short story frequently anthologized as an example of stream of consciousness narrative is The Mark on the Wall by Virginia Woolf. The narrator and her partner have just finished tea when she notices a mark on the wall a few inches above the mantelpiece. First, she thinks it must be a nail, which leads her to imagine what picture hung on it. Each thought leads by association to another, from Shakespeare to Sunday walks to the class and gender assumptions of Whitaker's Table of Precedency. At the end of the story, the images pile up and the narrator says, quote, I can't remember a thing. Everything's moving, falling, slipping, vanishing. Then the other character stands over her and says, I'm going out to buy a newspaper. Yes. Though it's no good buying newspapers, nothing ever happens. Curse this war, God damn this war. All the same, I don't see why we should have a snail on our wall. It would be overburdening this one-word images poem to suggest that it may reflect a wish for the reintegration of human civilization, the nail, with nature, the snail, although this was surely one of the cultural divides brought with the Industrial Revolution and climaxed by an industrial war which turned nature to a terrible wasteland. I return frequently to the suggestion that these tiny poetic fragments of becoming point to the wholeness of being, which is missing, just as many in a period of cultural fragmentation yearned nostalgically for past wholeness or a future wholeness yet to be discovered. In a 2013 collection of essays on Imagism, critic Helen Carr suggests that the image, quote, was an attempt to make the complexities of modern life cohere, end quote. She concludes, as I will, by quoting the Irish poet Seamus Heaney's observation that the haiku-like images poem captures the haiku's, quote, sense of evanescence, of the transitoriness of things, of the stillness behind things into which they will eventually pass, and also of the pathos of